Hi everyone, this is Laura. I hope you can all hear me. I'd like to thank our presenters, Kelly and Vi, and I would like to thank all of our participants. We have quite a lot of Q&A. I will do my best to try and get to as many of them as possible that will be relevant to as many of you all as possible. If we don't get to anything, my apologies, but this has been a really lively discussion, so I think that's fantastic. I think I will start out. There are a few questions about program design. I'll kind of group these together, and either Vi or Kelly, feel free to just jump in. Hopefully Adam, our AV person, can control the muting issues as well. So there was a question from Claire Durham about how do we ensure that we're picking the right points along the value chain to support it, and that we're kind of picking enough of the correct points along the value chain, right? Since if we ignore too many of them, then it won't function in any way. There's also a question about the prior wheat value chain, so it's more for Kelly perhaps, in terms of the high level of mechanization in the pre-war model of wheat production. And so how do we go about sort of replicating a productive wheat system if we can't necessarily afford to replace expensive inputs such as that? Particularly given the cost and availability of fuel. And then finally, there was another question about whether there was any use on either side of mobile technology or social media in terms of supporting behavior change or sharing price information for producers, or just raising awareness or providing general farmer education. That was from Indra Klein. I will stop there for a moment, and we'll try and tackle those questions, and then we will move to the next batch of questions. Vi or Kelly, over to you.
Hi, Laura. Sure. I can actually go. Oh, sorry, Kelly, go ahead. I was going to go with the last question, actually.
Either way. Yes, and I good. That's because I was going to kick that one to you anyway. So, perfect.
Oh, you were. Okay, so, okay.
In terms of the, I mean, a couple of the other questions in terms of kind of replicating the prior government system, I don't think we're seeking to replicate it as much as trying to support a new system, and I think we're still looking to see how that develops. You know, we are looking to provide subsidized inputs initially, but the idea is that ultimately we would be looking to shift towards cost recovery mechanisms and really supporting private markets and privately owned, privately owned facilities, and rather than to replicate a heavily subsidized and centralized system. But really to support some of those private sector actors and to, you know, just to provide an initial subsidy, but then shift towards a more privatized and cost recovery type mechanism along the line, if that answers that question. And in terms of how points are selected along the value chain for intervention, I mean, I will say we work with, we have both on staff and then we consult others through the food security livelihoods clusters and various other agronomists and others that had worked previously with the Ministry of Agriculture and other organizations in terms of, you know, what they see as the greatest gap and the greatest need. There's also, of course, the element of coordination with other NGOs and other actors to make sure that we're all not targeting the same points. And I would say we're limited a bit by donors as well in terms of what we're able to do. I mean, across our programming, it's multiple different donors that are funding multiple pieces of that. So we don't have a donor, for example, that's saying, okay, please, please tackle the wheat value chain and propose all these various points along that value chain. We've kind of cobbled that together just because we've found it to be a better practice for programming in terms of being able to link the various programs that are funded by various donors, but that's been really kind of our own initiative, and I think we're limited a little bit by the various donors in terms of what components of that each donor is interested in and will fund. You know, again, you have more donors that are funding more of the food security pieces, which then link into the other portions of the value chain. And the kind of, you know, infrastructure facility rehabilitation has different funders. And so we've tried to link that programming together into one comprehensive and complementary program But I think that's a challenge too, in being able to kind of sell that whole package to the donors, and trying to sell a longer time frame as well, in terms of rather than just a one-off here a seed distribution, but really being able to link that to the other pieces of the value chain, even if they have different funders. So with that, I don't know if Vi, you want to add to that as well.
No, I think you answered all of that. I think I wanted to take on that question around technology and social media, and I think that's a really important point. Is yes, people do have access to social media networks like WhatsApp and Facebook, and Syrians are really a community in that sense. They do actually, they're quite active on Facebook and social media like Viber and WhatsApp. So yes, these channels are available, and surprisingly, internet is sporadic but still available, and people are relying more on information and technology to be able to contact their friends or family or to find out about things that are going on. And I think that that's a very useful channel for us to consider. We definitely want to. We haven't yet, on our program on MissionCore, we haven't yet started doing that, but I think recognizing the importance of technology and social media and the access, particularly for the younger population, we are thinking of ways of how do we create those support networks, because there are constraints where people cannot travel from one location to another because it's front lines or the ongoing conflict. But if we do want to provide information and behavior change, information sharing, peer-to-peer learning, for example, are there technology-based groups? Can we create, for example, a facilitated WhatsApp group where we're able to provide some information and let this discussion continue? And people do willingly share information. If they find new ways to grow certain crops or new ways to do certain things, they are willing to share it with their friends and neighbors and the rest of the community. So I think there's definitely potential. It's right now something that we are starting to explore how we might make better use of it.
Okay, thank you. If I, Kelly, don't have further on that, then I will move to perhaps the next grouping of questions. There were some, Kelly, I think these are sort of specific for you in terms of the wheat value chain, and just questions about the fixed price of the bread, just clarifying whether this was more to benefit the farmers or the consumers. And then given the current situation, of course, when everyone's decreased purchasing power, whether people are able to buy bread. I'll just chime in a little bit briefly from the USAID perspective, which is that among other activities, USAID does support bakery voucher programs that help people afford bread through as normal of a market system as we can. Then there were also questions around sort of what does privatizing the wheat value chain, which was previously so government controlled, sort of what do we think that might do to bread prices? What do we think that could do in terms of a food security perspective? And I'll stop there. Kelly, I suppose those are both for you, but then our next grouping of questions will certainly be for both of you.
Sure, thank you. All good questions. As far as I understand, I mean, the government control on bread prices was a benefit to consumers as well, more so than farmers. Although I would imagine that there was a, certainly a government benefit between the calculation of what they pay for subsidizing the, the wheat inputs in terms of the seeds, et cetera, what they're paying for the crop harvest, and then fixing the bread prices, and then what they're exporting. So, I mean, ultimately, I think it's a government benefit within that entire value chain. Specific prices for bread, I would assume, would benefit the consumer as well. And what we're seeing now is actually in terms of the price controls, we've seen some localized price controls. For example, in say the Kurdish controlled areas, we've had some of the local councils and other local authorities in those areas that are fixing the prices of bread, again to benefit the consumers. But that's balanced with the challenge there is that the production is so low right now, which is what we're trying to then increase, that it's hard to keep those prices fixed. But they are, I mean, we've seen kind of local authorities and local groups that are trying to put caps on bread prices as well. And I would expect that to continue, frankly, until the we get some more conflict resolution, or until the production and the a lot of the other aspects of the value chain are restored or improved. In terms of privatizing the wheat value chain and the impact then on food security and prices, you know, the government model was in the process of collapse pre-conflict. Again, because it was unsustainable and it wasn't giving, it wasn't giving the yields that it was anticipated, and it wasn't a sustainable model. So I think the privatizing will actually have a positive impact eventually. I think it'll create some volatility in the interim, certainly, and along with everything else for the conflict. But I think there'll be some volatility in prices and potentially on food security as well. In the interim, but I would ultimately see that it would be a benefit to the consumers and the farmers as well, just because you are seeing now a lot of private seed traders. A lot of the inputs are being imported from Turkey, from Iraq, from elsewhere, but you are seeing now some seed multiplication efforts and some other an expansion of trade inside Syria. And I'll say that just from our own programming, back in 2014, we were not able to procure any seeds inside Syria. They just didn't exist. They weren't there. And now most of our procurement for the inputs is done within Syria. Not all, but an increasing portion is done within Syria. So I do think we've seen a restoration and at competitive prices, perhaps not as subsidized as they were previously with the government subsidies, but at competitive prices. And so I think it will ultimately, again, volatility probably in the interim, but I think it'll ultimately have a positive impact on both the price of inputs and the prices of bread for consumers, as well as benefiting local farmers.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that, Kelly. Our next grouping of questions is all about access to finance, and these are for both I and Kelly. We have questions from quite a lot of folks, including Lena Hansen, Ben Ersing, Tom Shaw, Robbie Yazbek, and Indra Klein, including sort of questions around, first of all, why is finance a constraint? Are there any financial institutions functioning or MFIs in the areas where you're working? Whether there's an access to finance component in either both of your programs. For the wheat, whether there's a crop insurance component considered. Whether there's any financial literacy included or whether that's needed. And then as well, if there are any other financial services pilots or other successful lending interventions in the Syria context, which you may or may not be aware of. I will leave it there. And maybe since Kelly just responded to a lot, maybe we'll pass it to Vi first.
Yeah, I'll start. I can give Kelly a break. I can go on the first question on access to finance and is finance a constraint? And I think that's a great question. I think even pre-crisis, I think if you've seen some of the World Bank reports, I think remittances that were coming in were like close to $1 billion. But pre-crisis, so pre-2011, after which we've stopped tracking, we've not been able to find these numbers. But the point is that even pre-crisis, pre-2011, there were large parts of Syria where there have never been any formal banking mechanisms available. So if you take Northeast Syria, for example, it has been primarily informal mechanisms, and there have been a few microfinance institutions, but very few, right? So this was even pre-crisis. Right now, the situation is we do actually know a little bit more about access to finance inside. And the point is that formal banking mechanisms are not functioning anywhere inside Syria. Very few locations, maybe Damascus and some of the other government-controlled areas, but primarily because of the conflict, right? The second, so this basically means when people need access to finance to restart a business or to even meet household consumption, it's either that they're relying on remittances, which is slightly higher than it was pre-crisis, but it is starting to reduce because I think 7 years into the conflict, even the migrants that have left the country and gone outside, I think they're facing hardships as well. So it's been more and more difficult to send remittances more regularly to people inside Syria. So when they think about access to finance, it's either remittances, if they receive any, if they have people outside, or it is primarily borrowing from friends or family or their sort of immediate social network. And again, if you think about the poverty levels inside Syria, you either have people that are really rich or very poor. There's no that sort of middle income group. So if you're trying to borrow from your own friends and family, 7 years in, there has been considerable erosion, so you don't really have many sources to borrow from, right? The other form of informal lending, you do have private money lenders, but as people are borrowing or as the demand for finance has increased, people, this is a new practice where people say, people have told us that the charging of interest or haram, which is considered haram under the Islamic tradition, has started with private money lenders because they're basically trying to find ways to protect their investment. If they are loaning out to someone, by changing the guarantees of payment or the structure of the payment, they're basically trying to protect their investment. And I think this comes down to, like I said before, business-to-business lending is still happening. So large agricultural dealers might still be loaning to smaller businesses or smaller businesses still loaning to farmers. But it is very constrained because, one, there is no rule of law to guarantee that the payment is going to come back. Two, there is no trust that this person is actually going to pay. And three, if there is a bomb tomorrow and the whole investment wipes out, or the whole farm wipes out, or the business wipes out, what are they going to do about their repayment? So while there used to be access to microfinance or finance even before, it's very, very limited now, and limited primarily also because of the constraints of the current crisis. So if we are finding out that business-to-business lending is happening, one avenue for us to potentially look at is, rather than us doing sort of direct cash grants, are there ways for us to help rejuvenate some of these relationships, rekindle this trust relationship, so can we do loan guarantees? It's not something that I have an answer to right now, but I just want to say that there is the potential to be able to go down that pathway. And it's not going to be easy, but if trust is something we need to rekindle, then maybe that is an option for us to consider.
Thank you, Vi. Kelly, did you have anything you wanted to add around financial services?
No, I think, Vi, you covered it very well. The only thing I would probably add is that I think there was a mention of financial literacy. And I do think, I mean, again, for a number of the reasons that Vi outlined as well, I do think that's valuable because there was, you know, because even pre-conflict, there was no formal banking system. And I think for, I mean, for us, particularly when you're talking about farmers that have had all of those elements of their livelihood essentially controlled, and they haven't had to, you know, determine how they're going to, you know, for what price they're going to sell their crop, how much they can, you know, they haven't had to make that calculation previously in terms of how much they can spend on inputs, what is the yield going to be. So I do think some financial literacy in that sense would be useful. But again, I think Vi covered very well all the various aspects of financial access to financial services.
Great. Thank you, Vi, and thank you, Kelly. We'll move on to the next grouping of questions. These are from Gary Alex and Indra Klein. They're sort of about beneficiary or farmer producer choices and revenue, and then the choices that they make around that revenue. One is around sort of now that the pre-war system of government control of planting is no longer functioning, wondering if there were any signals that farmers have been switching their choices, maybe from wheat to certain higher value products, or not. And then also a question for both of you in terms of whether you're able to track beneficiaries' revenue that they're earning from their livelihood activities and determining how much of it they are tending to use for meeting basic living needs versus reinvesting into their business and production versus perhaps saving up for the future. And if this isn't known, wondering if there were plans to try and find this out. I will, either of you, I suppose. Maybe Kelly first.
Sure, thanks. Again, good questions. In terms of the tracking of revenue, so we do post-distribution or post-harvest monitoring just to go back and look at the yield or the revenue that the farmers earned from the initial inputs that were provided. We haven't gotten into detail yet in terms of how that's spent and the breakdown in terms of how much of that is used to buy inputs for the following year versus to buy, medicines, food, other items. But we are planning to do that. I think now that we've had a longer time horizon within Syria, I mean, I'm going on 4 years now that we've been operating and doing these similar programs. At the beginning, it was just going back once and trying to get a sense of what revenue was earned. But I think now that we've got a longer time horizon, we are looking at going back to some of our initial beneficiaries from a couple of years ago and doing some initial analysis in terms of what they were able to earn and then how that was subsequently spent or invested in other items. So I think that's, So again, we've been able to track the basic revenue for now, but I think we're definitely interested in going back and getting some more details in terms of how much that's spent. I have not heard, not to say that it doesn't happen at all, but I have not heard of the farmers switching out wheat or others for more profitable crops. I mean, we've done a lot of consultation with both agronomists and farmers themselves in terms of putting together the seed package that we provide, which includes wheat or potatoes and a mix of vegetables, and the vegetables mostly for consumption and potentially for sale. But that was also that was based on the farmer request and what they, I think, are familiar with and what they would prefer to grow. So I haven't heard of any significant number of farmers switching to grow other crops. And certainly wheat is kind of the number one most requested input, so to say, for the farmers.
Just wanted to add to what Kelly just said about wheat, and I wanted to point this audience back to, there is a 2015 assessment that we did in Hasuke on the Mirishikor site that looks at this agricultural assessment of Hasuke. And I think as early as 2015, I think we were finding that farmers were switching out from wheat to other products, but I wouldn't say they were higher value products. I think it's products that they could more easily sell in the market, right? So I think they kind of switched from wheat into things like black seed and cumin. And I think that also had to do with cost of inputs. Again, like the subsidies, like Carrie mentioned, these subsidies were no longer coming in. I mean, being a wheat farmer used to be like having a salaried job, right? But since these inputs that they had to procure themselves, and it was more difficult, the cost of these inputs were getting higher. We did have these instances of people changing from wheat into other products, but not, I wouldn't say higher value. I think it's faster selling. And I think that was one of the reasons why we started a slightly more rigorous examination, to say, if markets are switching, markets are changing, people are changing their buying and their production cycles accordingly, is that change just sort of anecdotal in one or two locations, or is it a larger, wider change that we're seeing inside there? And I think this is where are people adapting their livelihoods to maintain their sort of food security, and if so, how were they doing it is what we wanted to look at within that Syria study.
Great. Thank you to both of you. Our next grouping of questions is a little bit about, I would say, sort of demographics of beneficiaries. There are a few questions from Sherry Arnott and Indra Klein in terms of whether a gender analysis was done for either project and among women farmers or women-led small businesses, how are they faring and what sorts of hindrances or obstacles do they face, if any? There was another question in terms of displacement. If either of your projects are working with displaced populations, if there have been efforts in terms of trying to create trust, trying to improve trust and respect between displaced and host populations, and or addressing any sort of resentment or suspicion. And then finally, there was a question in terms of intergenerational issues, perhaps among households and families or among producers, and whether there's any sort of knowledge exchange or perspective changing that might affect a successful project. I think let's do Vi first. I think last time Kelly went.
Great, thanks, Laura. Let's start with that last point you raised about intergenerational. I read that question and I was, I think I might have to Google and find out what that meant, but let's talk about intergenerational linkages, you know, and if there's any changes. We are finding that there isn't a huge male youth population that's left in Cytherea. There are still a lot of young women that are in Cytherea. I mean, that in general, I mean, just encompassing that women question as well, women-headed households in Cytherea is on the rise because either people have left, the men have left to migrate to other countries to see if they can provide a more stable livelihood, or they've joined armed groups as a source of income or ideology, whatever it is that suits them most. So women, there is a rise of women-headed households, right? Among the youth itself, what we are finding is that young people are very interested, not just in sort of earning an income and supporting their households, right, but also in terms of the self-esteem that it provides. So just the fact that they're able to provide for their household has improved their self-esteem and improved their willingness or desire to engage in community rebuilding, right? So I think those are important softer components that we do need to capture, particularly as we start talking about when the conflict ends, there is a demographic that's going to need particular attention, that's going to need to rebuild this community. I think it's definitely that younger generation that we need to be focusing on, right? Are there intergenerational learning or changes that we're seeing? I would say I don't have the answer, but I would say it's quite feasible because the younger generation is more into technology, is more able to access the information that they need. And by design or default, because of the conflict, they have now taken on this role of being the main income earner in the household. They have become the main decision maker because there has been no other choice, right? So I do think that we will soon be seeing a shift. We need to capitalize on that younger generation and make sure that that shift is a more peaceful transition and a more cohesive one for the community, right? Women-led businesses, do we take a gender lens? We absolutely do. And again, like I said, we do look at women-headed households. And one additional constraint, I think particularly for Syria, is the cultural constraints of women's engagement in the market. It's not that women were not earning an income before inside Syria, but that class of people, most of those who could leave have left, right? So the people that are still remaining, who are still inside Syria, are much poorer, and they probably do not haven't had the education or the exposure to engage in the market like women did before, right? So women-headed households are more vulnerable than the rest of this population, but they also lack those specific skills to engage in the market. But they are on the rise. There is pressure on them to earn an income for their families. But I would again want us to take a very market supply demand lens here and say if women-headed households are on the rise, it basically means that we can look at more opportunities to increase non-traditional livelihoods for women, right? If I was a woman in Cytherea today and I need something done in my house like plumbing or carpentry work or whatever that needs to be painted, would I be okay with a strange man coming into my house to do it, or would I be okay with a woman coming in to do it? So I think there is an opportunity here where women are, this rise in women-headed households, it is a niche consumer base. We want to expand that space within the cultural constraints. We want to see how do we use this to link up women producers and women consumers so that they can actually work well together, earn an income, and still not put themselves in harm's way because of currently, the cultural constraints still don't allow that open engagement. But until we get there, what can we do? On the displacement, I don't actually have much to add on the displacement. I'm there. Kelly, do you want to take over from here at this point?
Sure. I think you've covered the in terms of gender and kind of the intergenerational learning. In terms of the displacement, I mean, I would say only for us particularly, and with this very specific subset of beneficiaries that we're working with, being the small-scale farmers, we're not looking at a lot of displaced people. You know, we have other activities in terms of, you know, shelter and wash and other components that are much more focused on those who have been internally displaced. But I think for this particular subset of beneficiaries, we're working with a lot of host communities. You know, the farmers that we've worked with have been, many of them have been temporarily displaced in terms of they have left their land for a few weeks or months to move elsewhere and then come back to it, but their land is their asset. So they're, we don't have a lot of folks that are displaced. And part of our criteria is, you know, demonstrated ownership of the land that you are farming and that we're providing inputs for. So, I mean, I would say, again, for this particular subset of folks within Syria that we're working with, it's not a lot of displaced populations.
Well, sorry, I'm just going to follow up on Kelly's point, because I think that displacement issue, which reminds me, so when we talked about that hybrid model of the owner-raiser, I think that was particularly where some of the more vulnerable households were these displaced households, but they didn't really have this access to a barn or access to water, whereas the host households that did have access to this didn't really meet the vulnerability criteria. We do know that displaced households are, because of the multiple times that they are displacing, they've lost their previous assets, they cannot bring some of these assets with them. So, and they've also lost those social connections from their previous community, right, from the place of origin. So they are, in fact, more vulnerable than host communities. And it doesn't mean that we need to ignore the host community entirely in this intervention. They're also vulnerable in different ways. But again, it is about part of the question was, how do we rebuild that trust? It's not that there isn't trust between these two. Most displaced households or communities go to places where they might have some extended family, or they might know someone, or where they feel relatively safe. So it's not that it doesn't exist at all. It is about how do we distribute aid in a way that maintains this sort of social capital. If displaced households are going to their host neighbor as that immediate person, go-to person when something happens, how can aid come in and not destroy those relationships and still continue to maintain that? Which is why, again, for me, that owner-breeder model that I talked about was an interesting one, because it was pairing two such demographics, and why that worked for some households and why not for the others would be an interesting follow-up question for me.
Thank you, Vi, and thank you, Kelly. Those are both really useful perspectives. I think here we are going to close out the questions. I'd like to say a huge thank you both to Vi and Kelly for presenting and answering everyone's questions, and certainly to all of our participants for a really lively Q&A session and chat. A few of you had sort of factual questions about USAID's contributions. We will include a link to our most recent Syria response fact sheet in the post-event materials. Just a quick reminder that those, along with a recording of this webinar and the transcript, will be available within around 2 weeks. You can look in your email or, of course, at the Microlinks website for that. And also just one more reminder that Microlinks will be taking off in December for the holidays, but we will be back with events in calendar year 2018. But again, a huge thank you to everyone.